Coming up, Recovery Radio, a program of the Enlightened Radio Network, featuring the host James Boyd, and it broadcasts on a regular basis, Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. Alternatively, if there's doctor's appointments for the hosts, it might broadcast later in the day, but we'll always get a podcast up the same day. As much as we can, and welcome, and stay tuned here, coming right up. We're at the starting point. Why don't you give us an intro here, brother?
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. My name is James, and I'll be your host on this morning at the start of the Enlightened Radio, a show on the Recovery Radio podcast this morning. We're going to be talking about some really cool stuff this morning that should interest everybody. Not too morbid, but right on target. You know, we're going to talk about the current events of gun violence. We're going to bring it to you raw this morning. So I hope that everybody just pays close attention to this podcast this morning. And my name is James again, and we got John working the keyboard over there on the ones and twos, if you like to call it. Yeah. Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm zeros and ones, man. I can't get to two. I just got to deal with the zeros and ones. You know. Good morning, James. It's great to be here with you.
So what you got for us this morning, John?
Well, yeah, I got to tell you that my thing from which I want to recover is the fear of violent death. You know, that has been confronting me on the headlines. Whereas I feel like I've been injected with a drug that makes me, you know, because I watch murder mysteries on TV, you know, like on Netflix or whatever, that I should not, and I go to sleep every night afterwards mostly. You know, that therefore I should not be bothered when I turn on the news and it's no different than the movie I watched the night before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mass murders, kidnappings, you know, just terrorism of every description. And, you know, it seems, here's what's happened to me, James. It's happened so much. And one of the crazy movies that I watched, and I think the name was Shooter or something like that. Anyway, I think it was that. Anyway, the point was is that some lunatic. No, it was a Tom Cruise thing. Some lunatic killed five people to make it look like a mass murder, when actually he was only interested in one of them being dead so he could take their property, okay? And but anyway, the whole idea was is that, you know, a big serial killer, mass murder, you know, task force got set up. Nobody looked at the, you know, that there might have been, why would someone kill five people at random, including a baby, right? You know, make it just, you know, as horrible as you can. Well, to disguise the actual murder. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking, holy mackerel, what if something like that's going on in these killing sprees that are everywhere?
Yeah.
You know, like it looks like it's a crazy person, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And maybe it is. But, you know, I mean, we know that there are people involved in cults around the country, both many of them online, and then they meet in real life and, you know, practice weapons training and, you know, whatever.
That's right.
We know there are people who can be triggered into laying down their own life to carry out a quote mission, end quote.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right.
We know there are those people. Mm-hmm. We know they're out there, and then you think about the people that run these networks, you know, that fund these militia type outfits, the Proud Boys. He's right. I mean, I hope the feds are taking a look at the bank accounts of all these mothers, you know, to see about that. So anyway, we have an epidemic of murder that may be a cover for actual targeted killings. And our communities, our public schools, especially in, they're failing. Because who wants to send their kids to a slaughterhouse to school?
And education malpractice.
And you can't even send it to a private religious school anymore because they were the target of one of the most recent, you know, shootings in Nashville, Tennessee. Therefore, yesterday, you know, a bank employee goes back in and wants to blow away his coworkers, and he's live streaming it as he does it. Of course, he's dead. The cops kill him.
Everybody's killing everybody.
You know,
that's the flavor of the day. Depends on what part of the country it is you're in. It used to depend on what part of the country. Now it's doesn't matter.
It doesn't
everywhere.
Matter. Yeah.
We used to say, and I have a couple of good points that I want to bring up about this because it has affected me as well, and you know, as my family, I see the dysregulation and all of the conversations are around something tragic, something that happened tragic yesterday, you know, and then people are suspicious of what might happen tomorrow or the next day, but it's all cultivating, it's all culminating around violence against humans. Violence against one another. I got a poem here, John, that I'd like to share a little bit of, if you don't mind.
No, please.
Bear with me. The children of the murder of children haunts everyone's dreams with nightmarish echoes of preschoolers' screams. Parents bent double on knees at school gates, hands over eyes, enduring heartbreaking waits. The wailing of sirens and sisters and brothers and aunties and uncles, grandparents and others, red flashing lights and uniforms all around, mean only bad news on a foredoomed school ground. There are so many questions to ask and to answer. Why is there so much desperation and anger? Why not give people mental health care they need? Why are some drug companies so full of greed? Medical care is a luxury for many. They reach the weekend with nothing but pennies. Put food on the table or take care of health is the choice people face with no comfort of wealth. But why target children with hope in their eyes and sweet loving hearts full of joy and blue skies? Why kill young school kids just starting their lives? There are no good outcomes when a little one dies. Our schools should be places of learning and caring, exploration, discovery, and kindness and sharing. Schools should be safe zones for everyone in them, not a battleground for violence or vengeance or gunmen. Traumatized teachers try to keep fear at bay with morning anxiety. Could it happen today? Turning schools into prisons for our daughters and sons is no more solution than teachers with guns. Sending kind thoughts and prayers will never suffice for victims of gun violence and the correspondence of vice. For those feeling helpless, there is power in your vote. Don't let the guilt of inaction get stuck in your throat. Why do we tolerate a world full of guns? Shootings don't happen when people have none. Thanks for listening to this. John, you know, that is such a powerful set of words that are displayed in terms of what we need to be paying attention to in a really dramatic kind of way. There is trauma floating throughout the universe, man, and they're just passing it around like it's candy. And especially nowadays with the gun violence, this is unprecedented. Our kids are experiencing something that we're not prepared to help them with after they experience these things. You know, people are just left to their own vices and to find their own way, you know, out of trauma's abyss. You know, you're in that darkness of trauma, and it gets cultivated by time because it's unresolved. And once a child becomes an adult, then there's a great possibility that that adult might become your next mass shooting killer, you know. Or, you know, you go somewhere thinking that you're going to go out on a shopping day, and you're met with gun violence. You go to the beach for a lovely time, and you're met with gun violence or some sort of act against another human being, like in crowds. You know, I'm hoping that our guest Vicky comes on and
hope she finds us too.
Yeah, she said she texted me and said that she would be in 7:30.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay, I sent out a repeat invite too. Yeah. You know, I love the poem, James. It made me, you know, before we started the podcast here, it made me think about the ancient, you know, rappers and poets, right? I mean, someone told me that Homer lived 400 years before his poem was written down, or at least to anybody's knowledge was written down. And so that means it had to be passed on as songs, pretty much, right? Chants or whatever, and maybe, you know, 20 generations of children were raised on campfire songs that were about these guys in Troy, you know. how important the stories and the narratives that we use to explain where we are. It makes me think that the moral crisis that the murders are creating. I mean, there's a political and social crisis because public institutions, you start to get the idea, you understand why security is pretty much a requirement for civil society, okay? I mean, and the way in which historically, you know, we've evolved to solve that is that we say, even though there are pros and cons to it, we're going to give the state a monopoly on violence. Because if we don't, you know, I mean, every time you try to collect a debt, you know, someone's going to get shot. Right? I mean, that's what happens when when you're trading in illegal goods, right? I mean, how do you enforce contracts? Well, if you don't pay me, I'll kill you, or I'll try to.
I'll kill you. Exactly. I mean, no ifs, ands, and buts.
I can't go to court. I don't have a prison system, so, I mean, what are you going to do?
What do you do?
You know, we're going to are you going to do business or not?
Money.
But, you know, that's a trauma-ridden economy, boy, when you're operating that, you know? We got to have... it's not working. People are arming themselves. They don't trust the state. And for good reasons in many cases.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, in many cases.
The cops aren't defending me. They're actually shooting me. I mean, what's going on here, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
and I think the idea that violence begets violence is not an idea.
Yeah.
It's not an idea. It is front and center in 3D. Violence upon me, I'm going to commit violence upon you. And the kids do not differentiate. They don't, their young minds cannot distinguish between what is right and what is wrong right now. And we keep driving, twisting the corkscrew into that by adding layers and layers of misunderstanding, you know, to a kid's life. So I'm part of a Stevenson Moses Boxing for Life Corporation in Newark, New Jersey, where the great African-American young prize fighter, Shakur Stevenson, and his son brought so much hope to the city of Newark, New Jersey, as of late. The young man, Shakur Stevenson, has won so many medals and titles. He was given the key to the city of Newark, and, you know, just lots of things. And when I watch him interact with these children in Newark, New Jersey, it's just amazing to see the bright shine in their eyes. And it's all because of him and his family, Boxing for Life, and they teach kids skills that help them, you know, things that that they can take home, you know, the behavior, the grades in school. Young kids are not fighting, they're solving their own problems, you know, with anger and how to harness that anger and how to shift that anger and how to redirect that anger. And they came in abruptly, whoever they are, I'm not sure yet, and shut the place down. Well, they told him he had to vacate the premises in a certain amount of time. And also, if he didn't pay them $1,000 a month for the use of this facility. Now, he's been in there probably 3 or 4 years training the young fighters. I think it's the Housing Authority in Newark, New Jersey. So they came in and this ripped the whole place apart. And I watched these kids that showed up for their practice sessions and their safe space. I watched them crumble before my eyes. And some of them, you know, how kids do, they have these tantrums where they stomp on the floor. And, you know, one kid just snatched his boxing gloves off and threw them on the gym floor. But he didn't understand. You know, and I actually heard one of the young teenagers went outside and said, "These MFs are getting on my nerves. Every time we try to do something," that's what he was saying. So the owners, the people that run the building, and Coach Wally, whatever kind of words they had, you know, they solved it in a second because he decided that he was going to take a stand, and he said no. And so,
interesting.
He said good. No, and he started getting his mounds and mounts. I thought that the facility owned all the equipment that we were using. I'm talking like a big truck full of weights and boxing gloves and weighting bags. That all of that stuff belongs to one entity, the Stevenson Moses Boxing for Life Corporation. When we finished stripping that place down, it was empty. Only thing they have left is a ring, a boxing ring.
Yeah.
And so as we speak, you know, we have a truck. And
interesting.
And actually, right after that, the community stepped up on social media with the outrage, right? But of course, you know that is just only a beginning.
Right.
But I think that these children are going to take it over the top in this city.
I hope they do.
Not the rest of it. The kids are starting to pound the pavement about that. Coach Moses put on social media that he already had a new location in mind, and it's almost solidified the new location, and it was done in record-breaking speed. So he got them to understand, the kids I'm talking about, not to despair. You know, it's just a delay of progress, not a denial, because the kids seem to be getting ready to become unraveled. It doesn't take but a nanosecond for something tragic to happen.
That's right. That's right.
So that's my take on that. Is anybody that's familiar with the Shakur Stevenson with the Stevenson Moses Boxing for Life Corporation. And if you happen to listen to this podcast, weigh in on that and tell me what you think. It seems that whenever there's a bright shining star in the African-American community, someone who has the leadership capabilities that come naturally. And in the past, we've always had older people as our bright shining stars. But when you get a young man, when you get a young man who comes from very, and when I say meager beginnings, that's an understatement. So he is the oldest of probably 8 or 9 siblings. I'm not sure of that number, but Shakur is the oldest. And, you know, his grandfather, Wally Moses, has cultivated this young man because he found out at an early age that he liked to box. And so he started just letting him have his dreams, start fashioning his dreams at an early age. I think he started at 5 or 6 years old. Now he's a national champion. And he beat someone the other week, international, a Japanese gentleman. They had to stop the fight because Shakur is such a dominating force in his weight class.
Mm-hmm.
And the children, the kids that I was with at the Prudential Center were in such jubilation around their guy. That's their guy. You know, I hear them in, when they talk, as kids do, talk to each other, and they claim him as their guy. So it stands to reason that anything that affects him in a negative way, when they get wind of it, it affects them immediately.
They got a solid little group there.
Oh, solid is an understatement in terms of how the camaraderie takes shape. Right. Whenever a new child comes into that facility, the other kids, they surround him with kindness and respect, with fun. Right away, they start telling them how much fun it is.
And they've been taught to do that too, right? I mean, as a welcoming thing, or
they've
spontaneous.
They've experienced that from the coaches.
Okay. Right.
Everybody shakes and greets one another often. Mm-hmm. Nod heads, yes. You know, you're getting a lot of yeses instead of a lot of noes.
Yep.
And when these kids experience so many positive things in their life, and then all of a sudden it's snatched away.
Yep.
You know, it creates, and we have to have a great respect for traumatized individuals. Individuals who are traumatized and nobody knows that they're traumatized because there's so much. And for a young mind, it doesn't matter too much about the stigma on the outside or on the inside, because it doesn't affect them on the inside. But on the outside, other children or other older people see an individual get away with stigma. They get away with it. It cultivates the stigma. And then it passes that behavior on to the next generation and generation and generation and generation. And so the kids are left without hope. And what they do is they arm themselves emotionally against another hurt. And so, and here's where the trick comes in at. Another event that seems similar to the past event will be related to the past event automatically by your central nervous system. It'll recognize something that's not even the same thing, but it gets coded as the same trauma. And they try to avoid it. Fight, flight, in a lot of cases, freeze. But usually in a young mind, it manifests itself into anger. You know, you want to do something to protect that good feeling that you feel when a Shakur Stevenson comes into your life. Your nervous system wants to automatically protect that. And you possibly, and especially young mind, don't even realize what's going on inside them, you know, because no one has come along and helped them to be able to navigate that feeling. I think we have our lovely guest.
I think we do. I think as soon as she comes on here, I think you're going to need to introduce Vicky.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, and I am so excited for this young lady because we've been friends. I met Vicky on the political trail, and we just clicked right away, and it's just, you know, the rest is just history. And so I'm going to bring her on. Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Oh, great. Great. You know, it's great to hear your voice, Vicky. You know, so.
Good to see you again and to hear you, John.
I'm at a virtual beach, but James is at a real beach. Look at that blue sky outside his hotel.
I can kind of see the difference. Yeah, right. Well, James, where are you?
I'm in Atlantic City.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a while. Hey there. Look,
yeah. Yeah, it's been a while. It's been too long, actually.
It has been way too long. And you know, James, you mentioned the campaign trail, and it you know, it's about that season again. Mm-hmm. And you know, we may have to link up again.
Let me do a station ID for a second, so that everyone knows we're on this is the Recovery Radio program on Enlightened Radio's network, www.enlightenedradio.org. There also actually is a Recovery Radio page on that site called recovery.enlightenedradio.org, and maybe we'll keep posting this podcast up there, so because you can comment on that page if you would like to as well. Anyway, James, I was just going to do that. We're broadcasting here Thursdays at 7 a.m., unless the host has a doctor appointment or something. This is a little bit of geezer radio, but we're having a good time. Anyway, while you continue there, James, let me take my dog out. My dog's telling me that.
Okay. I want to get right into it because we got a really good interview here for you folks this morning, Miss Vicky Wiltshire. Vicky, good morning again, Vicky. Actually, I could never tire of saying hello to you.
Ditto.
Yeah, yes.
James, before we dive in, I may be having some technical difficulties. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. It doesn't appear that my camera is working.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we decide to do video, then he'll put it up. But usually, here of late, Vicky, we've been just sticking to the audio part of it. But I think we do this just for the fellowship, the podcast. But,
I still want to be the person who is messing up the flow.
No, everything is good, Vicky. It's so really so nice to be talking with you, to link up. I feel empowered already. By the way, because I know that
you and me too, James Boyd. Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you've been doing here lately.
Well, you know, I'm still kind of doing my coaching, my coaching work, which does keep me busy. You know, I'm primarily involved, or I should say, one of my biggest clients is the state of West Virginia, actually the Department of Health and Human Resources. I do a lot of work in their neglect and abuse cases. And so that keeps me busy. Of course, I'm writing, and you know, I will do some public engagement work in the DMV area as well. So it's been busy, if nothing else,
to say the least, huh? Yeah, I think you're fading in and out a little bit, but that's okay. Not to worry, Vicky. I'm going to keep the flow going. You know, I'm so excited about, you know, all of the especially the new activity that's coming along on the front where the presidential campaign is getting ramped up and people are throwing around different phraseologies to name something that hasn't occurred yet, you know. And so for us on this end, right, up here in the city, Well, I'm sure you're familiar with that feeling, being from down in the Washington, D.C. area yourself. It's the warmer it gets, the more intolerant people seem to become. You know, they come out of the darkness. And so when I talk to you and I finally made contact, we've been doing a little acrobats with the phone. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, all right, get this sister on here, because things are happening that are lining up with what you were talking about in your latest book. And I was hoping that my sister would come on this one, this podcast, so she could actually finally meet you after reading that book. She said, James, who is the lady that wrote the book? I want to meet her. You know, and my sister, she talks with exclamation. Her talking makes you feel like, you know, you need to, what she's saying is really, it means something to her. You know, her words, man. She could call you the N-word like nobody's business when we were young, right? But now, and I remind her of that often, because we don't talk like that no more. We realize what it did to us as children when we were allowed to continue to do that. So Vicky, tell us something about, you know, something really juicy we need to hear right from the gate.
Well, first of all, let me say thank you to your sister, and though she's not here, please, please, please let her know that I appreciate her so much for reading the book. It's a tiny book. It's a fast read. I hope that I've said something in it that you know resonates with somebody or motivates somebody, you know, to an action that they might not have taken before. I guess the juicy bits for me, given the climate that we're in right now, I think what I'd like for people to see as we look at Tennessee, as we look at you know, the killing of Roe, you know, these things did not just, you know, happen overnight. This is, you know, a part of the climb to whatever the culmination is going to be, whatever the climax is going to be. Mm-hmm. But I mean, these things have been, I think, and I try to kind of make this point in my book, is that these things have been in play for years and years and years, and we've just kind of been too busy to pay attention and to take any steps, you know, to address or even stop, you know, these kinds of activities. I mean, you know, we've been killing each other for a long, long time. Black people in particular have been, you know, dying at the hands of the police or people who want to be police, you know, Mr. Zimmerman. So for me, I guess what I'd like for us to kind of stop and do now is to take stock of where we really are. You know, none of this, you know, dressing it up and with fancy language and, you know, and trickery and, you know, machinations to I just think we need to stop and get real ourselves. And until we do that, this situation worse, my humble opinion.
Until we stop. You know, George Floyd spent a horrific 8 minutes and 46 seconds with a man's knee pressing on his neck until he died. And I think that those kinds of images open up a whole new area of thinking in a child's brain or in a human's brain, because, you know, we have come to the place where our own Black bodies don't mean enough to us. We don't mean enough to each other, you know. And we, to me, it seems like we've gotten in this country on some levels to where human bodies are less important than a pair of Nike sneakers.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this has been going on for so long. You know, Billie Holiday Billie Holiday put it nicely. You know, we've been swinging from poplar trees. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, imagine that image. That's a very real image from that long ago, and even way beyond that. You know, the images. This is what I'm saying: the images, the acts. You know, the feelings behind mm-hmm. those images and behaviors have been there since day one. Since this country began. And that's why I'm saying it's so important. You know, some of us are trying to act like, you know, the George Floyd incident, Trayvon Martin, those names go Emmett Till, you know, and beyond, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen this time and time and time again. And our response has been, maybe we protest, maybe we sing some Negro spirituals and, you know, and then we go home. And mm-hmm. and quite frankly, if I were in a leadership position, you know, president of the United States or governor mm-hmm. of the state, you know, and somebody said, okay, well, there's going to be a march, another march, you know, I would probably say, well, you know, get them some water and, you know, set up some porta potties for them, because what we know is they're going to march, they're going to give some speeches, sing some songs, and they're going to go home, and they're mm-hmm. going to just sort of wait until the next big thing happens. And we've got to stop doing that, because the next big thing is I think becoming almost minimal in our psyches now. That is, we are sensitized or desensitized to it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why Tyre Nichols' murder didn't even get as much press or play, you know, as George Floyd mm-hmm. or any of the other folks prior to Floyd, you know, because mm-hmm. we're so used to it now, as I would argue. And we nothing's changed. Well, I shouldn't say nothing. Let me not say that, because mm-hmm. we'll argue that point, but mm-hmm. little has changed. And I make that argument based on the fact that even after Floyd, there was a Tyre Nichols and several others in between. So, you know, we've got to stop, and we've got to take a different course, because what we've been doing has not worked.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that economically, we have to stop killing each other. Mm. We have to stop killing each other with, the crabs in a barrel. I don't like that little one, but that seems to be the one that fits mostly. It seems that when there's a bright light in our communities, either we stomp it out or the powers that be come along and get rid of it. And they do it through different channels of systemic racism, generational racism. I mean, when a person comes up with a really great idea, you know, we come along and either we like the idea, but we don't support it because we're not benefiting from the idea. So we'll just do the thing that we've been taught to do so often, and that is to, just give it the boot. This bright star has no place here.
I think that's born out of, in many ways, the vestiges of slavery and the separation of Black people, in terms of field and house slaves, you know, and that was the kind of divide and conquer strategy that, was instilled in us from the beginning. But interestingly, what, you know, I seldom quote Dr. King, because everybody else does, and it they make it almost passe. They make his, I think sometimes we quote or overquote such that we minimize the meaning of so much of what he was saying. But one quote that I will offer is when he talked about us being bound together, by the single garment of destiny. inextricably bound by the single garment of destiny. And so while, you know, Black folks, you know, may not really believe in our heart of hearts that our lives really do matter, or that our progress really matters, or that our ideas matter, going to what you were talking about, this is something also for the rest of America to look at, is that we are bound together. And when you pull this thread, this thread of Black American life in this country, the whole garment unravels, you know? And so while I'm not suggesting that, you know, as you probably got from reading, you know, my essays, of the five essays, the underlying point that I'm making is, this is work that we need to do as a community. You know, it's like the Bible says, charity begins at home. Many of the translations would be love begins at home. And you can't, any first year psych student or pop psychologist even will tell you that, you know, you can't love anybody else really and wholly and authentically until you have first loved yourself. And if we as a people love ourselves, to go to what you're saying, you know, to really live those words that Black lives matter, right? Mm-hmm. That our liberation really does matter, because we're not a liberated people right now. Some of us have reached, you know, the levels of being financially well healed, but we're, on the whole, I don't suspect that we're a liberated group, and that work is ours to do. That's for us to do. Now others can join in. But that is our work primarily, and I think until we do it, you know, trapped in the cycle that you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, and so they're breaking the glass ceilings, and they're hiring people of color to come in and clean up the glass. But we just don't come in to clean up. We're breaking these glass ceilings. I mean, there's so much stuff that's happening, and I think that you get caught up in all of the cares of the world that are being created in a systematic way to cause hardship and struggle. We dive right into that piece of it, the hardship and struggle, so that we can possibly say to ourselves, you see, you know, Black don't crack. We can do this. You know, that's why he made us like this, so we're strong. You know, all of that may be true, you know, but when it's unnecessary, you know, the same strength still exists in everybody, but it needs to be redirected. It needs to be repositioned. You know, it needs to be, like you said, reestablished in its validity. We don't even buy into the idea that we matter. Black bodies don't matter, not even to us in a lot of cases. And, you know, and guilty is charged for a lot of years. But once I find out, once I get some information, then I'm able to not be so hard on myself and kind of try and lead by example. I read that most powerful piece, Vicki, and everything that I read, I mean, chapter by chapter, after I finished, seemed to unfold. It was already there, but you just highlighted it. And I got a chance to look at it in another way. We're killing each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Stop killing each other. John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's just, when you were mentioning Dr. King, I guess the thing that I remembered most was his insistence that you had to, in order to get people to pay attention, or to make institutions respond, you had to make the existing status quo not work. I mean, when Vicki said, like, you know, the garment of destiny, but if you pull on one thread and the whole society's, garment starts to become unraveled, right, in a way. So, and I thought that, you know, he was a very profound and very highly educated guy. I mean, if you read all of his sermons over years, and which Carol finally taught me, my wife finally said I should read them all, you know, because they're really unbelievable. I mean, how much study that guy did. But the point in the end was, is that, you know, he was able to articulate a way for people to stop the machine from going forward, okay? And you can't go forward without paying attention and listening. And, and of course, a lot of other people, everybody was getting it at once, it seems like. Once he got it and the message got through, right? And I think everybody picked it up in different ways. A whole... you know, upheaval, you know, sort of a wave, right, crested. And, you know, it put a dent in things. I mean, the legislation that all got passed from 59 to 68 or 68, whenever the Voting Rights Act and the Great Society came in. I mean, that was the people shrugging their shoulders, right, and showing what immense power just doing that much had, okay? But I don't think it changed some of the systematic problems, and those have reasserted themselves. And we, in a way, we have the same old problem, only somehow it's bigger.
it lays dormant. That's why it lays dormant. Yeah. And so Vicky, go ahead, jump right in there, Vicky. We're coming up on 7:46.
Okay. Well, I'll be real quick. The word
you don't have. Go ahead.
The word that jumps out at me, John, in what you just said, is institutions, right? What we are experiencing right now, I think, is, you know, just institutional isms, racism, sexism, classism, you know, ageism. And these institutions must be, I don't want to use the wrong word because I don't want it to be a let's defund the police, right? Like I don't want the word. So you guys may want to help me in choosing the word.
Yeah, that's right. You
know, the word that comes to mind is that these institutions, rather than saying they need to be burned to the ground and rebuilt, because on some level that probably is not realistic. And, you know, there have been some good things to come from these institutions. So maybe a good word would be, you know, sort of dismantled carefully and then rebuilt to fit the need to make them living institutions, you know, to give them some flex, right? Mm-hmm. Because things change. You know, Thomas Jefferson talked about the fact that, you know, it's almost idiotic to ask a man to wear, you know, the suit coat that fitted him when he was 7. You can't do it. Things change.
Right. Right.
You know, institutions, you know, that have no flex, you know, that are not able to change with the needs of its people, of their people, is insanity at best. And so I think the institutions, which is where I think Dr. King was headed, you know, as he was pivoting, something else we don't talk about, you know, I mean, this is the same guy who said, wait, I might have been wrong a little bit, you know, in my approach. I don't remember exactly how he got, so it's not a verbatim quote,
right.
But he was talking about, you know, I may have led people into a burning building here. You know, we need to pivot. Run away from the burning building, get the fire hoses, put the fire out, and rebuild the building again so that it has some flex and it can change as needed.
Right.
I agree. You know, one of the things with antiquity when it comes to policies and everything, it has rusted shut. You know, the progress. I mean, we got some 3-in-1 oil, some years and years and years ago, that has dried up and it has been rusted shut. However, like the pair of socks or the coat, you know, I had a vision when you said that, Vicky. I imagined John with his 5-year-old coat on today trying to get it on.
Yeah, right.
So I kind of had that visual. It won't fit. It will not work. And so, and most of the good look that I got at Antiquity in my life in terms of who's the leadership came from Martinsburg, West Virginia. I never, because I hadn't been really too concerned about the politics until I went to a city council meeting down there and found that there were no people of color anywhere in the place. You know, one instance I went, there was everybody in the place had guns. They were white. And everybody in the place that was without guns was black.
Yeah.
So, I didn't think it's strange because, you know, I was thinking about too many other things like paying rent and stuff like that. But it's just so much imbalance in things that we see. And things that we gravitate, because most of the children that I worked with right now, they see a lot of people of color going to jail and getting carted off to jail. And so when they see somebody, a person of color do something that's great, and then all of a sudden that person is snatched out of their lives, it creates trauma. Vicky, I want to ask you, and we don't have that much time, about moral trauma. In your field, do you guys ever discuss that?
We live it probably. And there is a great deal of moral trauma going on. And, you know, just in every aspect of life, you know, I mean, when you cannot work, when you cannot get proper education, you cannot get proper health care, you know, this is the breeding ground for trauma, moral and otherwise, you know. But you said something, you know, when you, when you think about morality, you know, I love Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. I love who she is. I mean, naturally, I don't know her personally, but the things that she seemed to have stood for, her presence, her grace, that sort of stuff, I really, really appreciate it. But she said something once that I absolutely almost jumped out of my skin when she talked about the fact that, you know, when they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. And while morally I understood that, right, I would have responded were I having coffee with her by saying, no, when they go low, we go nowhere. Because they go low and they slice our Achilles heels. They slice us at the ankles. We cannot move because they come to the fight with knives and guns. We, perhaps out of some sense of morality, show up with words and you know, hope and things, you know, sort of these inanimate things.
Anecdote, t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah. Thank you. And it doesn't make sense. And you cannot go to a gunfight with a slingshot and expect to, I guess maybe you could. I mean, you know, David did it, but I just don't know the reality of that. The reality level kind of scares me. And so, you know, it's one thing to be moral, I think, and to just strive to be a good person. And it is another to be courageous and to believe in things and to be willing to fight for those things. Now, while they are separate things, they are not mutually exclusive. You can be a good person of high moral, right? And fight for what you believe in. In fact, I would think
good trouble.
Yes. So I don't know why why we, I think Black people in particular, think these things mutually exclusive. I kind of do know why academically, maybe intellectually, I get, you know, because we've been taught, you know, passivity is the way. And I go, that goes back to Dr. King saying, wait, well, passivity, oh, yeah, good. But, you know, don't run into the burning building out of passivity for passivity's sake. So I think that's sort of my short take on morality, where it might get us.
Yeah, a lot of interesting new ways to look at some of these old problems. And you know, and hearing from folks such as yourself, Vicky, and my good friend John, is very good in a lot of ways, especially for the people who follow me and they listen, because they come back and asking me questions about what someone said and what do I think. So the book and everything that we do opens up conversation. But the conversation must lead to action.
Thank you for saying that. Yep.
Amen.
Yep. I'm gonna go with you on that one, John. Amen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we? I think we should bring the podcast part of this to a close, you guys, because that way we keep the podcast around 40 minutes and.
Okay.
45 minutes.
Okay.
So why don't we officially close this podcast? Vicky, thank you so much for participating in our discussion today. And you're listening to www.enlightenradio.org. And this is the Recovery Radio program. We broadcast live Thursdays, most Thursdays at 7 a.m., except I think I have a doctor's appointment occasionally, which we might do it later in the morning then.
That's why we got this flexibility.
Yeah, flexibility on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, welcome to everybody. You can always find all of our podcasts at podcast.enlightenradio.org or democracyroad.podbean.com. They're stored in both places.
You can go to Facebook and get on Recovery Radio.
That's right.
That's it. Yeah. James Boyd, look up Recovery Radio and go in there and make a comment and let us know what you think. And then we'll bring that content, whatever your questions are. We try to do the research, and because this is an information podcast, and we love sharing.
All right.